Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania, and earned a B.S. degree in zoology from Duke University and received her M.S. degree from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Since November 2008, she's been the founder and CEO of Positive Approach to Care, whose mission is to engage and support people experiencing the changes in brain function that accompany dementia and to help their families better understand the challenges they face. Her name, Tipa Snow. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Tipa Snow, who's the founder and CEO of Positive Approach to Care. Tipa, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you, Jack. I appreciate all the hard work you do to make things possible.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Yeah. So I grew up in West Virginia with a side trip out to Washington State when my dad was in the military. And my mom was the first woman in her family that ever went to college. But the story was that my grandfather was afraid he was sending her to college to go hunt a husband. But instead, she became a teacher, a phys ed teacher. And she was a real skilled phys ed teacher, but not necessarily one of the warm and fuzzy types. So my dad was in more, he was a guy who liked to do things, but he also liked to be busy. And maybe I get some of that from him. So he was the guy that decided we should buy a farm. And we bought a farm. So I lived on a farm. My grandma was a country woman, one of 13 kids, not necessarily got to go to school. So she was functionally illiterate, but she ran a restaurant. And so the truck stop. And I learned how to cook and how to clean and how to serve under her leadership. And so she helped raise me while my mom taught, my dad worked. And I grew up sort of between living on a farm, helping in a restaurant, and trying to help. I was the oldest of three, take care of the kids. My youngest sister was 10 years younger than me, so I was sort of the babysitter. So that was sort of childhood, and then as things progressed, my parents came apart, and we moved to Pennsylvania, and I started working with kids with developmental disabilities. So that's how I actually got my name. My name was Tina, T-E-E-N-A, but what happened was a little boy with autism and a speech problem couldn't say Tina, so he called me Tipa. Tipa, tell me, Tari. Tipa, Tipa. So all my friends and family picked it up. So eventually, everybody called me Tipa, so I legally changed it to Tipa. So Michael named me.
How did you first get started, Tipa, in this line of work of caring, being a caregiver, dementia, et cetera?
Yeah. So when I was a little bit older, not much older, and I was a kid, my grandfather moved in because my grandma died. And we found out and figured out that something was going on with him. The reason he moved in is from Cleveland, we got a phone call, and they said he's trying to break into people's apartments. He thinks he's a superintendent, and he hasn't cared for the apartment buildings, and we don't know how long. So we had to go get him. And my mom turned out to be not such a good caregiver. She would try to tell him, Dad, Mom's dead, remember? And we know now that he had vascular dementia. Back then, he was just getting weird, and we couldn't get him to understand that she wasn't coming back and he couldn't go back. So what happened was I turned out to be a lot better at working with him. So when he said, I want dinner at 5, and my mom didn't get home from work till 6, I learned to cook, and it wasn't great. It was hamburgers and hard meatloaf and mashed potatoes made by hand because couldn't get them in a box back then. But he demanded there be vegetables on the plate. So I just opened green beans and threw some green beans on because I wasn't very old and very smart. And he ate everything but the green beans. And I said, Grandpappy didn't eat them. He said, well, I don't want them. They're just supposed to be on the plate. So I figured out, you know what? Don't argue with him. Just give him what he needs, and he's going to be much more satisfied. So that was my very first experience, even without a label. And after that, it just came up and came up. And I worked in head injury and developmental disabilities and people with strokes. And once again, dementia, my grandma, and then later on, my mother-in-law. But it opportunity after opportunity, and I'm a very curious person.
Can you talk to us about the miracle we call the human brain?
Yeah, so it's one of the most magnificent things around. And the tricky part for us is we use it every day without understanding how it works and why it works and why it doesn't work. We take it for granted, and sometimes we then abuse it. So our brain runs everything from start to finish, and many of the things it does, we're totally just sort of like, of course it does. So regulating heartbeat, regulating blood pressure when we change positions from lying down to standing up, being able to moderate our blood sugar and let us know when, oh boy, you should eat something because, you know, you're running out of juice. Or, you know what, you're sort of thirsty, you probably should look around for something to drink. And then it even reminds us and lets us know, well, where is that thing that I could drink found? How could I get there? How do I get back? Oh, watch out, there's something there on the ground. We don't realize how much it does for us until it doesn't. And when it comes to things like dementia, it's a lot trickier and more involved than people tend to think. People recognize some symptoms. What they don't recognize is what's missing until it sort of slaps at them. And then they, again, keep thinking there's a way to get somebody to do something that they're not doing. Because previous experience that showed us that were children. Children can learn amazing things with their brain because their brain is preparing itself. But you can't teach a two-year-old to safely drive. So you have to teach in the moment when the moment's right for things to come in and be present for someone. And the hard part for us is when it's dementia, how do you fill in the missing pieces without trying to reteach something that people can't get but not give up on things they have?
What's the difference between dementia, Alzheimer, and mini stroke?
Ah, so really good questions. So if I were to ask people to put an equation sign or a math sign between those words, so what I would say is dementia is greater than Alzheimer's, and it's greater than mini strokes, and Alzheimer's does not equal mini strokes. And dementia does not equal Alzheimer's or mini strokes. So what we have, if I could have people imagine, is a great big umbrella term called dementia. It includes somewhere between 105, 110, 120 different conditions. Now, under that umbrella, we do find Alzheimer's disease. But we're even finding out with Alzheimer's, there's lots of different variations. It's not all one thing. So people could have a genetic code for it. They could have a genetic predisposition, a risk factor for it, but not actually. Or you could just live your life in such a way as you expose yourself to risk and spontaneous mutation. So that's Alzheimer's. But when we come to mini strokes, well, mini strokes are where you have an event and it's a blood flow event in your brain. So it's not your brain cells getting sick, which is what happens in most other dementias. In this case, you're just not getting oxygen and nourishment to your brain cell. And when that happens, those brain cells typically suddenly, there's a blockage or a blow up. What ends up happening is the brain cells that were receiving their oxygen nourishment die. So what happens, though, around that is you create blood flow around, and there are still healthy brain cells all around, so you can recover some function. You lose a little bit if it's a stroke. It doesn't come back, but some things do come back because of what we call neuroplasticity. However, what that tells us is there's a dead little place in your brain, and there's dead nerve cells and there's dead blood vessels in there, and it appears that increases your risk of irritating your brain and increasing the risk that you have the potential now for developing Alzheimer's or vascular dementia, where your brain flow issues keep going, and it gets into that little microcirculation of your capillaries, and it spreads. And so 5 to 10 years after strokes, you start to see deterioration. And it's not from big strokes. It's from the leftover problems from your mini strokes. And that's just two examples of all the kinds of dementia. We've got Lewy body and frontal temporal lobe dementias and alcohol-related dementias. I mean, there's a host of different kinds of brain failure. All of them are brain failure, so they're all types of dementia.
We're talking to Tipa Snow, who believes that dementia is not a medical condition, it's a life-altering condition. When we come back, we'll ask her what she means by that. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible, a News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Tipa Snow. Tipa, you say dementia is not a medical condition, it's a life-altering condition. Explain, please.
Yeah, so we tend to think about if we have something like Alzheimer's or Lewy body, okay, we'll go see a doctor, and the doctor will be able to tell us what to do so that we don't struggle with the symptoms of the disease. And the problem is, with all of these conditions, because your brain runs everything, we're talking about a condition that affects everything. It's not just whether or not your blood pressure is up and so you take a pill for blood pressure. We're talking about your brain isn't working for you the way it used to, and you're going to have to adapt and adjust. And the bad news is, so is everybody around you. Because sometimes you will be aware of what you can't do, and sometimes you'll have not a clue. And it's not because you're not trying. It's because part of your brain in the prefrontal cortex, the very front of your brain, the problem solver, the executive control center, is actually broken. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know when you're incompetent. You don't know when you're not making sense. You think you are because you've always made sense before. You've always made good decisions before. So what people struggle with is the people around you are seeing the inconsistency. And so they're saying, Dad, what you're doing doesn't make any sense. Or, sweetheart, that is not what I said. You're misinterpreting me. And the person living with dementia goes, I am not. I heard what you said. And their brain actually tells them that's true. And so we end up in arguments or disagreements. And that's not necessarily what a doctor is really trained to help you with. How to live life now that your brain is tricking you all the time. So we're going to need more support. We're going to need legal support. We're going to need housing support. We're going to need financial organization support. We're going to need help with relationships. We're going to need people who help us to get smarter and better at dealing with this thing that keeps changing. And so it isn't really a medical condition. It is life-altering for me and for everyone who cares about me. And it keeps changing.
If you want to learn more, www.tipa, T-E-E-P-A, snow.com. And Tipa, in 2008, founded Positive Approach to Care. Speaking about helping, what do you say to the primary caregivers, please?
So the first question is, what do they know about dementia and what has been their life experience and what is their skill set coming into this? Because the primary caregiver is going to have an unbelievable load eventually to carry. So we need to get them on board a little at a time. And to get somebody on the train, we want to make sure they know where the ticket's taking them and that they are prepared for the journey. Because did they pack their suitcase? Have they got the support in place they need? And one of the biggest mistakes care partners make, caregivers, family members make, is thinking, well, it's not that bad. I can handle this now. When it gets bad, then I'll do something. And it's like, ooh, when it gets harder than this, you won't have the energy or the time or the availability to do something. So what you want to do is pack your own suitcase before you start getting on the train with somebody and go check out what are you going to need for this journey, because it's a marathon. It is not a quick sprint up the road. It's not a quick run. This is, on average, for most people, somewhere between 5 to 8 years of very active involvement or decision-making for someone who's always been a decision-maker. So caregivers need more support than they think sooner than they need it. So caregivers pause, time out, take a deep breath, and look around. Who will be your support as you try to support someone? And what do you know? And what don't you know? And what's involved here? Because this is really complicated to try to help someone else live their life.
Okay, another statement you make is that be aware that your loved one's field of vision has narrowed dramatically. Please.
Yeah. So one of the really vital parts of your brain actually is the back of your brain called the occipital lobe. And its job is to take in all the information that your eyes deliver and make sense of it and send it to the other parts of your brain so you can use it. And what happens when you develop dementia is your brain is being affected, not just the hippocampal area and the memory center, not just the thinking and the reasoning center, not just the language center, but the vision center too. And so one of the things that happens is my brain can't handle all the incoming data. So it has to decide, well, do I pay attention to the edges, my peripheral vision, or do I pay attention to the center? And the brain's pretty smart. It goes, well, the middle is where you get all the good detail. The middle is where you pay attention to what's actually happening. Peripheral awareness just means you notice something and then you have to turn to look. Ask anybody who develops and lives with macular degeneration, and you'll get a really good sense of the horror of not being able to see the middle of the field of vision. So the brain decides, okay, pay attention to the middle. Well, as my capacity to pay attention goes down, I can't keep in my awareness all the world, so I narrow my field. So by early stages of dementia, people are actually living with basically tunnel vision. It's basically putting on a scuba mask and living with it. So it means if you touch me on the shoulder from behind, I startle and I jump and go, geez, why did you sneak up on me? Because with normal vision, I am aware of your approach and I prepare myself in my brain for your touch. But when I have tunnel vision, I have absolutely no awareness. By the time I'm in mid-stage dementia, it's like I'm wearing binoculars all the time. And by late in the disease, I can't organize both eyes to organize it themselves to present me with one integrated image. So I become monocular, which means I can only process one image and I have no depth perception or trajectory ability. So it's really, really complicated. Our eyes are the windows that we view everything with. And so I'm losing that.
Another piece of advice you say is don't be shocked or judgmental when the swearing starts.
Yeah, our brains are this amazing thing. And again, it just always is fascinating to me what people notice and what they don't pick up on. So we have two sides to our brain. And for the vast majority of us, 98%, the left side of the brain is where we find our formal language skills, our vocabulary storage, our comprehension of speech, our ability to actually produce sound after sound, to form words, to form sentences, to form thoughts, to form ideas, to share them. What happens with almost all forms of dementia is that area of the brain is highly vulnerable, whether it's mini strokes or whether it's Alzheimer's or whether it's frontal temporal dementia. And so what I lose is my formal language skills. What I keep, however, is a chunk of brain that we use to protect ourselves and to calm ourselves and to feel better. And that area is more located to the right. And so what I'll keep are my forbidden words, swear words, sex talk, racial slurs and cultural slurs and ugly words. Shut up, you're an idiot, stupid. And so all of a sudden, words that were forbidden become the available words. And whenever you make me emotional, they're right there. And so they're my warning signs that you're getting on my nerves. They're the warning signs that if you don't stop doing what you're doing, this is going to get worse. They're also the warning signs that if you don't stop what you're doing, this may become physical, because we fight with words as a last-ditch effort before we fight with our bodies. And so those warning words are signals of distress. And instead of reacting, we want to go, whoa, boy, did I tick you off. And I don't even know what I did. Oh, it's because you can't find the bathroom. Oh, and the reason you're saying the word you're saying is that's what you need to do. And you're using a word you would never have used. Well, quit worrying about the word and start paying attention to the need. And that's a tricky thing when it's my husband.
We're talking to Tipa Snow, America's dementia caregiver. If you want to learn more, www.tipasnow.com. One other thing you say, it's a little surprising to me, is as the dementia progresses, spend less time together. Why?
Yeah. A lot of people are surprised about that, because what happens is we get so committed, we get drawn into the disease. But the more time I spend with somebody who's so different than the person that I used to love and know, the more all I see is their dementia, because I am so missing the person I used to have. So what I have to condition myself for is I'm not exactly how I used to be either. I'm changing. And if I spend all my time with this person who's different, I really miss the person who was, and I'm not getting what I need. So when I look at you, I see you as less. I see you as gone. I see you as missing. Instead of going and taking care of myself while I make sure that you get someone in your life who can support you when I'm not there and fill some places that you have need when I'm not there, so that when we are together, I can find you and I can like you and I can want to be with you, because when I'm not around all the time, I can still find you better than when I'm always there and I'm doing all this hard work. And it seems like it's just so hard to locate you. Now, if you're not finding that when you're with me, you miss me, then stay with me. But if what's happening is you grieve me almost every moment you're present with me, I need you to go grieve me away from me and then come back and see me. I'm still here. I'm different. And I can't be who I used to be. And you can't have it the way we used to have it. And neither can I. So we're both grieving. But if you will find the way to let go of what you can't have, then you'll realize what you can. I'm right here. But you can't have it the way it used to be. Neither of us can.
We're talking to the founder and CEO of Positive Approach to Care, Tipa Snow, who also talks about gem-level approach to caring for people with Alzheimer's. And I'm Jack Rizzullo, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rizzullo, and we're with Tipa Snow, America's dementia caregiver. You also talk to us about GEM level approach to caring for people with Alzheimer's disease. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so some of the models that we have out there, all of the models we have out there, speak to loss. So, for instance, when I worked with the Alzheimer's Association, which I did for quite a while, we had a model that was called early, middle, late, and it was called early loss, middle loss, late loss. And so what we talked about is what people wouldn't be able to do, so what we would have to take over. So early in the disease, we'd have to become a supervisor. In the middle of the disease, we were going to have to actually become a watcher and a monitor and a task giver and somebody who was present 24/7 to make sure they did what they needed to do and didn't do what they shouldn't do, but they still could do things. And then late in the disease, we were going to have to take over responsibility for doing things. So it was going to be a physical as well as a mental activity, and it would be 24/7. And even moving in the bed or taking a bite of food would be something we eventually would have to manage. So that's how we first saw it. And so it was all in terms of what can't they do, what can't they do, what can't they do anymore. So what are you going to have to do? And then there was the global deterioration scale, which is a 7-point scale. And a lot of people talk about it, like what stage are they in? And it acts as though there's a permanent position. Once you get there, that's where you stay. You're in stage 5 or you're in stage 6 or 7. And again, it focuses in on what people can't do anymore. And it also only focuses in on certain parts of the brain. So it really is really tuned into the hippocampus. What can't they remember? What can they not think about? What are they not going to be able to use language-wise? But it doesn't focus in on whole brain, and it doesn't look at what they still have. So if I were to ask you if you like donuts, and you say yes, and I say, well, how many of you like donuts because they have a hole in them? Well, the answer is Well, that's not why you eat a donut. You eat a donut because of what's still there and what you like. And that's what I decided we had to figure out. If I'm going to spend time with somebody who's in brain failure, I want to focus on what do they still have that I can use? What do they still have that I can support? What kind of care can I give so they do the best they can? And I felt like an image of global deterioration and loss and this idea of severe dementia and profound loss was not a helpful image. So what if I started talking about sapphires and diamonds and emeralds and ambers and rubies and then pearls? And it's based on Allen cognitive abilities, which is an occupational therapy phrasing of looking at abilities and support and environments and interests. And how do I engage you so that you do what you have left, and what you don't have, I support and I provide the right care. So if you don't have the ability to come up with words, then what I say is, so Jack, do you like coffee or something else to drink? And you tell me, you either like coffee or something else. And I go, oh, something hot or cold. Otherwise, if I just say, Jack, what do you want to drink? Your brain has to sort through the inventory of all the words associated with what to drink. And then you have to figure out, okay, how do I say that word and how do I get out there? Well, I just gave you the support that you needed to pick coffee. But when things get rougher and you have a harder time coming up with things, what I can then do is hold up a mug of coffee right outside arm's reach and then a glass of water and say, coffee or water. And whichever way your eye goes, that's the one we're going to try. So what it does is it gives a caregiver the pathway to provide the right support rather than looking at what's not there and grieving it. I give you a plan of action. And that's what GEMS is all about. We have a plan of action to support that person. And we see what is so amazing and what is still great about them. And we let go of this idea that they're not there, because they are. Let's look at them and see them, and let's figure out what we can do to support them.
Tipa, the patience that's required by the primary caregiver is unbelievable. My dad sacrificed 5 years, yeah, the last 5 years of my mom's life, okay? It was unbelievable how he took care of her. The yeah, patience. What do you say to somebody that says, Tipa, sometimes I just want to scream?
Yeah, you do. And you know what? You need to go to a place and you do need to scream, because you got to let it out. Because what we're doing is building up the volcano. And we need to allow ourselves to feel that pain. That is real. That's real pain. He missed her so much, and yet he was so present for her. And that need to let it out without hurting the other person, that's why I say take a step away so you can recharge your batteries. One of the things we've done generation after generation is to believe that I have to do it all. That's the only way, because I love her. I must give everything for her. And I absolutely agree. You must do everything you can for her. And part of that, in that love she has for you, is she would never choose that you destroy your own health and your own well-being, whether you're a child or a spouse. That's not what I want from you. What I want is for us to have a good relationship. And when I can't be here anymore, I want you to be well. And so one of the realities that I try to help people see is patience is that moment when you recognize in yourself, I'm no longer in a true blue sapphire mode. I'm becoming a diamond. I'm rigid. I'm inflexible. I'm frustrated. So you know what? I need a little time and space to bring myself back. I need to know what I need to heal, because there are times when the best thing you can do in a child rearing situation is make sure the kid's okay and step back rather than step forward. And the same is true when you're trying to help someone whose ability is so changed. When I ask you for the 100th time, but I don't understand, why can't I drive anymore? And you're thinking, I just told you why you can't drive. We just went through this. You just said you got it. And now you, because what it means is my brain is tired. My brain is so worn out with answering the same question that I can't remember that you don't remember. It's not because you're not trying, but because where you used to store memory, your brain has a hole, but where you still have wiring is wanting to know why. And if you've ever taken a long trip with a kid in the back seat, why? It's the same idea, but what we appreciate is the kid is going to grow out of it. Well, I'm going to change out of it, and there'll come a time you wish I would ask you a question. So learning the art of taking breaks and breathing and giving yourself space, it's a critical part of caregiving. And what doesn't happen is people get trained in it. We assume everybody knows how to do it, but when you're in it, you don't. And so you wear yourself out rather than find that way through this maze. And so patience, part of it is recognize, I need to look in the mirror and see how I'm doing and take care of me.
We're talking to Tipa Snow, and she believes that the key is how I change rather than how the person with dementia has changed. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasul. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Tipa Snow, America's dementia care guru. If you want to learn more, www.tipasnow.com. We met through our mutual friend Keith Famey, the Emmy Award-winning director and producer. And a month ago, on PBS, his latest documentary, entitled Those on the Front Lines of Alzheimer's and Dementia, was shown. For listeners that want to watch that, to learn more, go to www.ontodaysfrontlines.com. And you were featured very prominently, and one part was, what can we do to try to minimize the odds of us getting dementia as we get older? And they talk about 10 ways to love your brain. Break a sweat, hit the books, butt out, meaning quit smoking, follow your heart. And then you talk about catch some Z's and take care of your mental health. What do you mean by that, please?
So what happens when we become caregivers is we become so focused on what we're doing, we forget to check in with our own system and what's working and what's not. So one of the ways to reduce our risk is we need to heal and recover. And the way humans heal and recover is they shut down to the outer world. And their brains and their bodies go inside, and they do a tremendous amount of work. They remove toxins. They form new memories. They get rid of stuff that doesn't belong there. They get your organs to work differently. It's a safe place, and so they're busy, busy, busy. And it's called sleep. And when we go into sleep, it's not a solid state. It's waves and patterns. And in different parts of sleep, you do different things. And part of what we do is heal our brain, get rid of stuff that shouldn't be there, recover, return things to a baseline, and organize stuff. It's a great time to organize all the stuff you did all day and get rid of that which you don't need and solid state that which you want. So if we don't get enough sleep, we're robbing ourselves. And one of the things we do is deal with protein and deal with protein malformations then and neuroprotect ourselves and get our immune system back up. So anybody who's ever traveled a lot, you know that you're at higher risk when you travel and you get exposed to things and you're not getting enough sleep. So sleep is vital for brain health. And one of the problems when you're caregiving is the person you're caring for, well, their brain is dying. And so one of the common things that happens is they don't sleep solid. They're up and down, and because their balance isn't so great, you're having to be with it. Or they get up and they say, listen, I need to go to work at 3 a.m. And you're like, well, they wake you out of a sound sleep. So without realizing it, you're gradually losing skill sets because you're not doing what you need. So again, the idea of building a team and recognizing when somebody's getting up a lot at night, I either have to change my pattern to match their pattern, or I have to find somebody else to be with them at some of the time so I can get what I need. Because otherwise, I'm increasing the risk of brain malformations. I'm increasing the risk of blood flow problems, of oxygen in my brain. But I don't need to do that. What I need to do is take a step back and realize, whoa, things that I need to do, get out there and exercise my body because it's connected to my brain. And when I change the blood pressure system and I get my brain active and my body active, it's really good for me because then typically I'll also sleep better. Let go of things that I can't fix, the worrying business, and instead socialize with people that I enjoy being with, which is the other reason I say, you know, if you're not having a good time with the person you really love, take a break so you can have a good time with them. You can't work 24/7. It doesn't it doesn't do you any good. It just wears you out. So sleep is vital, but so are these other things. And if we do those things, we reduce our own risk. And that's where we are with dementia prevention right now, risk reduction.
One other major thing you can do is fuel up right. Talk to us about the diet.
Oh, good heavens. The primitive part of our brain, when it gets stressed, boy, does it like the junk. Oh, it wants the glucose. It wants the caffeine. It wants the quick fix. And once it learns how to do that crap, I mean, and I say crap, I mean, it likes it because it gives it a quick rush. It fixes it real quick. I feel better when I do it. We learn the habit. And so our brains are now hardwired for the habit. And it's like, ooh, to break those habits. Wow, that takes a lot of focus and energy and support. So what I'd say is, you know what? We better get it and get it early. One of our bad habits is going to the quick fix rather than really looking at what's good for me to eat. How much do I need to eat? Well, I like a full plate. Well, then get a smaller plate because you do not need as much as you're putting in. And so what happens? The rest gets put in storage. Well, when you store that much stuff, you know, where are you going to put it? I mean, it's like having your closet shoved full of stuff you can't even find what you're looking for. So lean and mean, fresh and green, look at bright colors, look at time of day. When are you going to burn those off? Well, if you eat your heavy meal at night, it ain't going to be before you go to sleep. So that Mediterranean lifestyle and that idea of looking at keeping it fresh, keeping it light, looking at bright colors and looking at things that support life and that aren't so processed and aren't so, you could keep it for a year. It's like, well, if you could keep it for a year, should you keep it for a year? So looking at what you're putting in, how much animal protein, how much vegetable protein, are you having protein or are you going all glucose? Because our systems were never made for that much glucose. And partially hydrogenated stuff might be great for storage on the shelf. We aren't so sure whether it's that great for our brains. So what are you putting in? How much fluid? How much hydration? Boy, we should have more than we think because our brains get tricked into thinking that sugar drink, well, that was like water, right? It's like, not exactly. So we have to get smarter about what we're putting in because there's a payoff.
Tipa Snow, America's dementia caregiver and guru, keep up the great, great work. And thanks a million for being on.
Thanks, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasulla. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.